Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, welcome to the New Books Network channel. New Books in Jewish Studies. I'm your host, Ari Barbalat. I am honored to be in dialogue today with my esteemed guest, Dr. Vered Noam. She is a professor of Talmud at Tel Aviv University. In 2020, she received the Israel Prize for Talmud, the first woman to receive the prize in Talmud studies. She serves as an editor of the Jewish Studies journal Tzion, and is on the editorial boards of the Journal of Ancient Judaism and Dead Sea Discoveries. In addition to the book we'll be discussing today, she has also written two other noteworthy books. One of them is Megillat Ta'anit, Versions, Interpretation, History, published in 2003 by Yad Ben Tzvi Press. The other is From Qumran to the Rabbinic Revolution, Conceptions of Impurity, published in 2010 by Yad Ben Tzvi Press. We will be discussing today her book, Shifting Images of the Hasmoneans, Second Temple Legends and Their Reception in Josephus and Rabbinic Literature, published by Oxford University Press in 2018. In 2018, it was selected as a finalist in the National Jewish Book Award for Academic Books. Vered, it's an absolute blessing to be in dialogue with you today.
Thank you, Ari. I'm very happy to be here. Thank you for inviting me. It's a pleasure.
Thank you. I'm tremendously grateful. To begin, please tell us about yourself. Where did you grow up? And were there any formative events in your early life that stimulated the scholar you would later become?
Well, I grew up in Jerusalem in a modern Orthodox Zionistic family, deeply engaged in traditional Torah study, combined with academic learning. Mm-hmm. I was the youngest in the family, and my aspiration has always been to be part of the learned discussion of my older brothers at the Shabbat table. Mm-hmm. Gradually, this Shabbat table became a metaphor to the Jewish discourse of Torah throughout history, of which I wished to become part. You know, there was no yeshiva for girls at that time in which I could study Talmud. So I turned to the Department of Talmud at Hebrew U. And in the course of my studies, I became very curious about the emergence of rabbinic culture, which I believe had been a novelty in many respects compared to the biblical and Second Temple Jewish culture which preceded it. Later, I understood that the key to this question is the culture, atmosphere, and literature created in the last centuries BCE, a period of transition of sorts in which the rabbinic phenomenon is rooted. And so this is how I became engaged in finding connections between Second Temple literature, such as the Dead Sea Scrolls, Josephus, Megillat Ta'anit, and rabbinic literature.
What inspired you to write this particular book? What do you hope readers will gain from it?
Well, the Hasmonean Commonwealth had a great influence on Jewish history, even the Western history at large. This is the period which generated the emergence of rabbinic culture and Oral Torah, This is the era in which the intersectarian dispute has evolved and in which the Qumran sect was established and its huge library composed. And even the later birth of Christianity is rooted in this period. I wanted to research the image of this period and its heroes in the eyes of contemporary Jews, as well as its reception history, through the way early traditions on the Hasmoneans were preserved, transmitted, and reworked in two very different channels, Josephus's writing and rabbinic literature. I was also curious as to the extent of knowledge and interest the rabbis had regarding the centuries that had preceded them, namely the Second Temple period. I wanted to uncover the sources they had used when referring to this period. I asked myself, were they aware of Josephus's works, as well as to other Jewish extra rabbinic literature? Did they read it? Did they read Greek? Alternatively, if they did not want or could not use Josephus's work, as I contend in the book, they must have used some unwritten and unknown Jewish traditions used also by the historian Josephus. So I wanted to retrieve these lost, probably oral traditions, and decipher their provenance and aim. I also tried to trace the ways they were adapted by Josephus on the one hand and rabbinic literature on the other.
How does your book differ from previous studies on the Hasmonean dynasty and the way it was conceptualized by contemporary Jewish society and later generations?
I think there is a difference. Past studies examined the overall attitude of entire corpora, such as the Dead Sea Scrolls, Josephus, or rabbinic literature to the Hasmoneans. My book examines a series of Jewish folk tales from the Second Temple period that treat figures and events from the Hasmonean era. These minimalistic historical or legendary anecdotes are preserved in both the Josephine and rabbinic corpora, and I think that they are remnants of a lost Jewish literature, most likely transmitted orally. They probably circulated in the streets of Jerusalem during the century-long leadership of the Hasmonean dynasty and until the destruction of the Second Temple. Another difference between what this book does and previous scholarship is that the scholarship has examined Josephus's attitude towards the Hasmoneans based on his writings and his treatment of his historiographical sources like First Maccabees, Nicolaus of Damascus, Strabo, and also the way he used the material from his previous book, War, in composing antiquities. The rabbinic attitude toward the Hasmoneans is usually surveyed through compilation of halachic and agadic statements from Tanaitic and Amoraic sources that touch on the Hasmoneans. What I try to demonstrate in my book is that Second Temple period Jewish traditions concerning the Hasmoneans have to be defined as an early independent source that was secondarily introduced into both corpora. Because I think previous scholarship has been flawed on two accounts. First, by its failure to make chronological distinctions between the texts, the previous traditions that were embedded into these corpora, and second, by its lack of recognition of the reductional role assumed by Josephus and rabbinic literature. Let me explain, okay? Thus, for example, the tradition of Janius's deathbed instructions to his wife, in which he speaks a lot about the Pharisees, were perceived by scholars as Josephus's attempt to defend either the Pharisees or alternatively King Janius. On the other hand, the legend of the rupture with the Pharisees in its Talmudic version was understood as representing a rabbinic viewpoint that the Hasmonean rulers should have relinquished the high priesthood. To my mind, all these stories preceded both Josephus and rabbinic literature and feature their own messages. Moreover, at times, the corpus in which the tradition is cited imposes a contrary view on the story. either through its incorporation in a conflicting framework or through interpolation of subversive statements into the original story. So I think that a fresh perspective on the shifting attitudes toward the Hasmoneans can be gained by correctly distinguishing between the ancient embedded stories and their purposeful reduction in the Josephine reworking on the one hand, and in the reduction and transmission of rabbinic literature on the other. I think, for example, if we take one story, if we look at the corresponding versions of a specific ancient tradition that concerns Judas Maccabeus's battle with the Seleucid officer Nicanor, which was embedded in the books of Maccabees, in Jewish Antiquities of Josephus, and in several rabbinic sources. If we compare them, we discover that the rabbis omitted the hero's name only in the rabbinic versions. The hero is Judas Maccabeus in Maccabees, in Josephus, but when we arrive at the rabbinic sources, suddenly there is no name. There is one of the Hasmoneans. And this supports a claim of deliberate censorship on the part of the rabbis who were, for some reason, not interested in mentioning Judas Maccabeus, who is absent from their entire literature. And you can discover this only by comparison of these ancient stories, which are embedded in the different corpora. Another difference, I think, between this book and previous scholarship is that most studies take an overall view of the Hasmonean portrayal in rabbinic sources. And my study considers the attitude towards the Hasmoneans by generation rather than collectively. I think there is a difference between the military account of Judas's victory over Nicanor and the miracle legend of John Hyrcanus in the temple, and between the latter and the totally different genre that echoes the internal conflicts of Yanai Janius and his sons. And the last unique trait of this book, I think, is the fact that the legends on the Hasmoneans serve me as a lens through which I can decipher the nature of the relationship between the parallel stories preserved in Josephus and in rabbinic literature. Dependence, as some argue, or mutual reliance on traditions and memory available to both, which is the thesis I propose. So I think these are the special characteristics of this present book.
How were Josephus and the rabbis similar and different from one another as narrators and storytellers?
So I'll begin with the similarities. Both rabbinic literature and Josephus's works reflect an early Jewish cultural heritage of halakha, agadah, and exegesis, and also a shared platform of historical events, realia, Jewish lifestyle. This includes halachic hermeneutic aspects shared by both corpora and the striking storehouse of anecdotal traditions concerning post-biblical persons and events from Second Temple period, from the conquest of Alexander the Great to the destruction of the temple. The historical and legendary figures who are the foci of the parallels include Alexander the Great, John Hyrcanus, Alexander Janius, Shlamtzian, Alexandra, Hyrcanus, Aristobulus, Herod, Miriam, Caesars like Gaius Caligula, Vespasian, Titus, among others. My book compares parallel anecdotes related both by Josephus and the rabbis on the Hasmonean revolt and the Hasmonean commonwealth. So this is what's similar, but there are also many differences between the Josephine writings and rabbinic literature. Josephus' writings belong to the historiographical genre as practiced in Hellenistic Roman culture, whereas rabbinic literature is religious, didactic, exegetical, and ahistorical in nature. Indeed, Josephus and rabbinic literature present surprisingly different pictures of the same period. For example, Josephus speaks of military and political events, stormy political lives. His protagonists are people of action, generals, rulers, high office holders, rebels, soldiers. Whereas in rabbinic literature, we find halachic, exegetical, and agadic discourse against the backdrop of the temple and the study house, and the protagonists are rabbis, priests, religious leaders. For example, it's interesting that in the entire rabbinic literature, from the Mishnah to the Talmudim, Midrashim, etc., there is no mention of the names or deeds of the first Maccabees, the Hasmonean brothers, including Judas Maccabeus himself, whereas Josephus devotes nearly 400 sections to their deeds. On the other hand, Josephus never mentions the important schools of Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai, who receive over 250 mentions in the Mishnah alone. Josephus is also unfamiliar, it appears, with his contemporary, the religious leader Yochanan ben Zakkai, to whom rabbinic testimony attributes responsibility for building the post-destruction Judaism. So these are two so different and distinct depictions of the same period by very different corpora. Another difference, apart from those grounded in the expected gap between historiographical and halachic conceptual literature, lies in the proximity of the composition to the events. Josephus's works, as is well known, were composed not long after the end of this period, and he personally witnessed its concluding events, I mean the Second Temple period at large, whereas the editing of rabbinic literature spanned some 700 years. And the earliest composition, the Mishnah, was completed around 130 years after the destruction of the temple. It's interesting that the work with the greatest number of parallels to Josephus is the Babylonian Talmud, which was formulated not only at a temporal, but also at a pronounced geographical culture and distance from the events. Another dichotomy between Josephus and rabbinic literature is their orientation. Josephus is outer-directed, whereas rabbinic literature is inner-directed. Josephus, the historian, wrote in Greek primarily for a non-Jewish audience, whereas the Hebrew Aramaic rabbinic literature is an example of internal discourse within the circles of the rabbis and their disciples. Yet another decisive difference is the ability to identify the author. In the opening of the Jewish war, Josephus designates himself as follows. I, Josephus, son of Matthias, a Hebrew race, a native of Jerusalem and a priest, who at the opening of the war myself fought against the Romans, and in the sequel was perforce on an onlooker. And we hear his voice throughout the entire books of war and antiquities. Even in the conclusion of Antiquities, he concludes with the words, and now I take heart from the consummation of my proposed work to assert that no one else, either Jew or Gentile, would have been equal to the task, however willing to undertake it, of issuing so accurate a treatise as this for the Greek world. Now, in contrast, rabbinic literature is collective, partially anonymous, spanning many generations and places, and reflects numerous mostly unnamed voices, redactors, transmitters. This is very different. I would conclude with the history of the reception of these two very different corpora. I would like to cite the historian Yosef Chaim Yerushalmi, who wrote sometime between 75 and 79 CE, Josephus published his account of the Jewish war against Rome, and then went on to an elaborate summation of the history of his people in the Jewish antiquities. The latter work was published in 93-94, that is, less than a decade before the rabbis held the council at Yavne. By coincidence, the two events were almost contemporaneous. Yet, says Yerushalmi, in retrospect, we know that within Jewry, the future belonged to the rabbis, not to Josephus. So Jewish tradition actually did not preserve Josephus's books at all and did not transmit them and never studied them, but rather studied rabbinic literature. In terms of reception history, the rabbinic literature is the one that created and continued in Jewish culture. And Josephus's works were rejected outside Judaism and preserved within Christianity. On the other hand, of course, when we come to the modern period, so in modernity, both Jews and non-Jews grant Josephus the priority, of course, in the reconstruction of history over what were now seen as fragmentary legends embedded in a late folk creation lacking historical awareness of rabbinic literature. So we can say that the rabbis shaped Jewish collective memory over generations, whereas Josephus shaped modern scholarly historical awareness. And from this reason, I think it's quite intriguing to try to compare the way these so different and distant two corpora deal with the same period and the same anecdotes.
What contribution does your book make to the study of Josephus? Can you situate your book among existing literature on Josephus? How does your book differentiate itself vis-a-vis other recent books on Josephus?
In recent years, there is a scholarly debate as to the legitimacy of the study of Josephus's sources. Following the school of new criticism from the half of the 20th century, we find scholars harshly critiquing the use of textual criticism to explain difficult Josephan passages and contradictions. This trend intensified in the latter half of the century by virtue of the postmodern approach, which denies our ability to reconstruct any process of creation, even of a literary work as it was. Instead of the quest for the history of the text, reduction criticism abandons the question of how the texts were formed for consideration of the literary complex as it stands. It seeks to uncover the reducted text ideology and rhetoric and to discover its discourse with its audience. Thus, one of Josephus's major researchers, Steve Mason, downplays the importance of source analysis for an understanding of Josephus. He maintains that Cullen critique does an injustice to the original creative Josephus, portraying him as a careless plagiarist, incapable of noting the inconsistencies he himself created. On the other hand, another famous scholar of Josephus, Daniel Schwartz, sees no contradiction between study of Josephus's sources and investigation of his aims. He further argued that the first may contribute to the second. An accurate mapping of the materials received by Josephus from his predecessors, determination of their reworking and integration into his texts, and identification of Josephus's own contributions within the sequential narrative clearly point to his attitude and worldview, both as a writer and editor. I must say that at present, we're witnessing a renewed trend in several scholarly fields, for example, rabbinic literature, that suggests an integrated approach to the study of ancient texts, which seeks to reapply source criticism alongside the literary perspective. My study requires consideration of the question of sources at the most fundamental level, for I focus not on canon critique as a tool for understanding Josephus, but just vice versa, on Josephus as a tool for reconstructing the ancient Jewish materials that he used.
What can we learn from your book about the relationship between history and memory?
So I touched on this a little bit before. You know, various sociologists and historians noted during the 20th century a very sharp tension between traditional memory and critical historiography. The French sociologist Maurice Halbwachs distinguished between collective memory, which reflects a sense of a living, committed, relevant, subjective past, implemented through commemorative ceremonies and holidays, and historical research, the frozen reconstruction of a dead fixed past. The historian's efforts to achieve proof-based objectivity and to know the past as it was sever him, says Halbwachs, from the present and from the group to which he belongs, pushing him away from tribal consensus to the universal. In other words, he says, history begins where tradition ends. Yosef Chaim Yerushalmi's influential book, Zachor, applied Halbach's insights to the case of Jewish historiography. Yerushalmi argued that Jewish historiographical creativity ceased with Josephus and was fully renewed only in modernity with the beginning of the Wissenschaft des Judentums. This is how the French historian Pierre Noah described memory versus history. Allow me to cite. Memory is life, always embodied in living societies. Memory, being a phenomenon of emotion and magic, accommodates only those facts that suit it. History, being an intellectual, non-religious activity, calls for analysis and critical discourse. Memory situates remembrance in a sacred context. History ferrets it out. It turns whatever it touches into prose. Memory wells up from groups that it welds together. By contrast, history belongs to everyone and to no one, and therefore has a universal vocation. I think my book is an exceptional variation of the tension between traditional memory and critical historiography. Living memory is usually portrayed as the product of pre-modern periods and historiography as modern. Here in my case, the representative of historiography is an ancient author, Josephus, and the collective memory was preserved in works compiled centuries later, meaning rabbinic period. So it's the opposite. Moreover, if Halbach, Yerushalmi, and Noah describe historiography as murdering and inheriting living memory, in my instance, Josephus the historian adopted and embedded vestiges of folk legend in his historiography. Additionally, in the case of rabbinic literature, it was not history that ousted memory, but just the opposite. Memory replaced historical sense, as I said before, that the rabbis were not historians. So it's kind of a twist of the usual way we sense the tension between history and memory.
One theme in your book is the contribution of the Dead Sea Scrolls to our understanding of the Hasmoneans. You devote some significant attention to the Nahum commentary, Pesher Nahum in particular. How are the Hasmoneans depicted differently in documents from Qumran vis-a-vis both Josephus and the rabbis? What can be learned from the Dead Sea Scrolls about the Hasmoneans?
The late Hanan Eshel, who was also a good friend, has written a book which reviewed all the possible mentions of the Hasmonean state and contemporary events in the scrolls and subsequent research. In general, the sectarians were hostile to the Hasmonean state and its leaders. Their decision to abandon Jerusalem and live in the desert has probably been a result of their deep disappointment with the Hasmonean state, whose establishment had aroused unfulfilled messianic expectations. The picture in Josephus's writing and in rabbinic literature, I think, is more nuanced. Josephus admires the first two Hasmonean generations and critiques the later three. His narrative frequently exemplifies contradictory approaches due to distinct sources he had used. The excerpts from the Herodian historian Nicolaus from Damascus are much more hostile to the Hasmoneans than Josephus's own narrative or certain Jewish sources he had used. The rabbinic attitude also varies with regard to different figures in the Hasmonean Commonwealth. It is especially instructive to compare the depiction of the same figure or event in the Dead Sea Scrolls with its counterpart in the other two corpora. For example, both Josephus and the rabbis relate the same Jewish tradition on a semi-prophecy which John Hyrcanus experienced in the temple. Josephus further describes, quote, the three of the greatest privileges, end quote, that John has received from God, the rule of the nation, the office of high priest, and the gift of prophecy. Whereas Hyrcanus's supporters depicted John as an ideal prophet, victorious leader, and righteous priest, an antithetical negative echo may have been preserved in a Qumran text. In 4Q Testimonia, 4Q 175, the author juxtaposes Pentateuchal passages treating a false prophet, a future leader, and Levi's blessings, which have to do with a priest, alongside a passage that, based on Joshua, cast the deeds of the men of Belial and his sons in a negative light. According to Hanan Eshel, the author of the Qumran Pesher sought to reject political midrashim, which had interpreted the biblical description of the exemplary figures found in the Qumran text, an ideal prophet, victorious leader, and righteous priest, as applying to John Hyrcanus. So you can see a political dispute between this Qumran piece and what Josephus tells us about the supporters of Hyrcanus. Another example has to do with the downfall of the Hasmonean Commonwealth. A small fragment from Qumran K4, 4Q 471a, accuses the sect's opponents of violating the divine covenant. The scroll cites these adversaries as saying, quote, "We shall fight his battles because he redeemed us," end quote. The author, however, prophesies that they will be brought low because God despises them. The editors, Menachem Kister and Esther Eshel, plausibly conjecture that the foes in question are the Hasmoneans and their supporters, with the redemption mentioned by the opponents referring to the establishment of the Hasmonean state and the political successes of the first Hasmoneans. The passage goes on to describe the subsequent downfall of these circles. Indeed, the joyous reaction of the sect to the Hasmonean defeat is well documented in the Psharim as well. In contradistinction, both Josephus and a tradition appearing in the Talmud lament the downfall of the Hasmoneans. They believed that the Hasmoneans' previous victories represented divine redemption, and that their eventual downfall was due only to internal strife, which caused the last generation to lose their royal power. As opposed to the Qumranites, who deemed the Hasmonean state sinful from its very inception, Josephus states, quote, "There was a splendid and renowned house because of both their lineage and their priestly office, as well as the things which its founders achieved on behalf of the nation, but they lost their royal power through internal strife." So these kinds of political debates regarding the different figures and generations of the Hasmonean Commonwealth can be found along the my research in the book. And it's very interesting indeed to compare the Pharisaic standpoint and later standpoint of Josephus and the rabbis to the way the Qumran opposition regarded the Hasmonean rulers.
You refer many times in your book to the Scolion. Can you describe what this source is? How do the stories in the Scolion differ from other canons of Second Temple and rabbinic literature? Can you contextualize the Scolion for those who might not be familiar with it?
Well, I'll begin with a previous work named Megillat Ta'anit, the Scroll of Fasting. The Scroll of Fasting, the name is a bit misleading because it is a list of about 35 dates drawn up in Aramaic and arranged in a calendar order, composed towards the end of the Second Temple period. Its goal, as stated in its opening sentence, is to keep the Jews from fasting, and in some cases even eulogizing the deceased, on certain dates, because on these dates, happy events have occurred, many of them related to Hasmonean victories. The main part of the scroll is a list made up of short sentences, each of which includes a date and a happy event that occurred on it. The various events are referred to in the scroll by means of mere hints, characterized by extreme brevity. The times, circumstances, and protagonists of many scroll events are not explicit, and consequently, almost half of them have remained obscure. Now, because of this, an explanatory commentary in Hebrew was later added to the scroll, known in research literature as the Scolion. The intention of the Scolion was to identify and elaborate on the events intimated in the scroll. Thus, it adds stories, legends, and homilies of various types, relating directly or indirectly to those events. The main part of the Scolion was probably appended to Megillat Ta'anit during the Talmudic period. And since it treats some Hasmonean stories and traditions, it has to do with those historical anecdotes that I discuss in the book.
Is it appropriate to think of one Josephus or two Josephuses? What similarities and differences manifest in the presentation of the Hasmoneans in the Jewish War vis-a-vis the presentation of the Hasmoneans in the Antiquities?
Well, this is an interesting question because there is a big difference on which I base myself in throughout the book. Josephus's two main works, The Jewish War and Jewish Antiquities, which were written in Rome 20 years apart, mark a transformation of Josephus from a Jerusalem priest whose Jewish identity was grounded in the temple and its cults to a diaspora Jew whose identity derived from ancestral tradition, canonical texts, and study and observance of Jewish law. Many scholars, foremost among them Richard Lacquer, have noted that as compared to war, Antiquities displays a definitively Jewish perspective. Whereas in war, Josephus denounces the zealots who led to the destruction and praises the Flavian dynasty, which destroyed the temple. In Antiquities, Josephus takes upon himself the role of an advocate for persecuted, defamed Judaism. Daniel Schwartz has pointed out fresh proofs of Josephus's growing attachment to Jewish tradition while composing Antiquities. He elaborates on Jewish customs, defends Jewish law, uses Jewish terminology, which he had avoided in war, and what's most interesting and important for me is that he integrates Jewish folk tales about the Asmoneans, among others, into his ongoing narrative in Antiquities, which he did not do when he wrote War. I think when he wrote War, he tried to be, a Roman or Hellenistic historian. And he felt, I believe, that it would be inappropriate to integrate Jewish folktale into his narrative. But when he wrote, some 20 years later, Jewish Antiquities, he was more sure of himself, and he felt more, he identified more with his Jewish brethren and Jewish history and Jewish tradition. And he let himself use these materials and integrated them, whereas in places where in the parallel passage in War, they are missing. So whenever we see such a Jewish tradition integrated in Jewish Antiquities, whereas in War it does not exist, we can deduce, and this Jewish tradition also has a parallel in rabbinic literature, we can deduce that this is indeed a Jewish tradition which Josephus could extract from a pool of such traditions that he used, and he chose to use only in this new phase in his life when he emphasized his Jewish identity much more than in the previous work.
What can we learn about your book? What can we learn from your book about the epistemology of silence? What can we learn about the relationship between silence and collective memory?
Silence is actually a strategy, I think, is the main rabbinic strategy by which they cope with opponents and with materials which they are not happy with. So, for example, we now know that throughout the period of the Second Temple, there was a huge Jewish literature composed. We have the pseudepigrapha, and we have all the works that we found in Qumran, about 900 different Jewish works, and most of them were composed in Jewish factions that were not rabbinic or not Pharisaic, and some of them stemmed from priestly groups which were opposed to the Pharisees and which the rabbis later on did not esteem. And it's interesting to see how the rabbis simply ignored them. They never mentioned throughout the entire rabbinic literature, they never mentioned any such work apart from one, only Ben Sira. This is the only book that they mentioned besides the Bible and their own oral materials. So it appears that the rabbis actually decided to reject from the Jewish collective memory and culture, which they transmitted on, to to reject all these counter Jewish cultures and all other kinds of Judaisms that existed in their days and in previous centuries. And they actually deleted all this material by simply ignoring it. And actually they succeeded in this project, as we see that all Jewish generations who had traditional education, Jewish education, are not aware of all that was composed during these centuries of the Second Temple times. And a typical traditional Jew will tell you that all that exists from ancient times is the Bible and then rabbinic literature, and nothing existed in between. So I think this is also the reason why Josephus is never mentioned and also never used or cited within rabbinic literature. Against this background of kind of making us forget all the creativity of Second Temple times, the silencing of other Jewish cultures and works, the Jewish oral traditions which the rabbis did choose to integrate become even more important. This is what is left from Jewish memories of Second Temple times, and this is the only things that the rabbis did legitimate. So I would say that the attempt to retrieve these lost materials and traditions is kind of a way to cope with a silencing strategy or attitude of rabbinic literature with regard to the Second Temple period.
As we bring this interview today to an end, what are you working on next as your current project? What are you working on now as your subsequent project?
Well, I'm currently preparing a new critical edition, including a fresh translation and commentary of one of the Dead Sea Scrolls named Miktzat Ma'asei HaTorah, Some Precepts of the Torah, for the Oxford Commentary on Dead Sea Scrolls. This scroll is framed as a letter aimed at convincing a political leader of the veracity of the sectarian halachic stance. Its main part is a sequence of polemically formulated legal statements, and they enable recovery of many of the issues fueling the intersectarian controversy of that day. So this is another way of examining the emergence of rabbinic halacha from the period of the Second Temple times.
Thank you for your attention and your erudition, which you shared with us today. It's been the most humble honor to be in dialogue with you and to learn from you so much. As we bring this dialogue to a close, I have been your host, Ari Barbalat, with the New Books in Jewish Studies podcast channel, part of the New Books Network. I have been talking today with Dr. Vered Noam, who is a professor of Talmud at Tel Aviv University. And in 2020, she received the Israel Prize for Talmud, becoming the first woman to receive this prize. We have been discussing her book, Shifting Image of the Hasmoneans, Second Temple Legends and Their Reception in Josephus and Rabbinic Literature, published in 2018 by Oxford University Press. This book was selected in 2018 to be a finalist in the National Jewish Book Awards for academic books. Thank you
so much, Ari. It has been a pleasure.